Lecture given by Firoz Mehta on the meaning and significance of religion at Zoroastrian House, London, on Sunday, 22nd April 1979. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, ceaseless change marks the world process. This change may be fortuitous, haphazard, perhaps useless and purposeless. Or it may be regressive, sometimes so regressive as to be harmful and even destructive. Or it may be a progressive change which leads to our growth, our fruition, and our true fulfillment. What are the influences determining this change? Strange as it may sound, the most powerful influence is consciousness, which is the root source of all our thought and feeling, our speech and action. Thought, feeling, speech and action in their turn affect consciousness, so that it is a mutual relationship between the state of our consciousness and all its expressions in our daily life. The next powerful influence is our needs, bodily, psychological, and psychophysical. There are constructive influences, such as good health, good upbringing, good education, good companions, and a good environment, and best of all, our own good sense, a good heredity, and intelligence. There are destructive influences too. Ignorance first and foremost. And one of the most important points to bear in mind in connection with ignorance is the fact that we are ignorant of our own ignorance. We human beings do not at all like it when anyone makes us feel that we are ignorant or that we have been in the wrong. We presuppose that we are usually, if not always, in the right. Now, this is a very important point to bear in mind. We are also ignorant of the ways of the self within us. That means that we have no true self-knowledge. There is wrong desire, wrong motive, vices and wayward impulses, self-centeredness and self-indulgence, ill-breeding, bad companions, the sheer misfortune of deprivation and disease, bodily and mental, the misfortune of parental neglect and mistakes, the misfortune of brutalization by circumstances and environment or by oppression. Perhaps the strongest influence for destruction is the lack of vision. You all know the saying, where there is no vision, the people perish. And that is very true, a fact which is completely borne out in the history of the world. If we do have vision to perceive those elements in the change process which are in harmony with the trends of life, then it is our personal responsibility to cooperate with the life force, promoting growth and leading to fruition and fulfillment. Let us briefly consider our needs. Our bodily needs, we all know. Where sheer needs go, they are simply food, warmth, and shelter. These influence and lead to, and at least in part, shape our psychological needs. Here we come to something very important and something which affects our entire life, our psychological needs. Happiness, love, peace of mind, security, a congenial job or profession, some degree of success in our everyday life, social acceptance. These needs in turn lead to our psycho-spiritual needs, to which not many people pay attention or at least due attention. Our psycho-spiritual needs are the sources of knowledge of the purpose or purposes of our existence. If you talk to people in the world and ask them what they think, what they see rather than what they imagine is the purpose of their existence, you will find that they are very, very uncertain or very dogmatic because of the conditioning which has been imposed upon their minds by their own cultural background. Our needs are to know the profound or transcendent potentialities within us and the springs of inspiration showing us how we may live and grow so that our full and truly human stature may be realized. These needs must not be regarded as quite separate needs in watertight compartments. They actually constitute a unitary whole for the very simple reason that each one of us is a spiritual and psychophysical individual, which means an indivisible unit. Before realizing maturity of mind, before our spiritual nature is in full command, we function mainly at the psychological level. The psyche is ambivalent. It functions in terms of the opposites: love, hate, kindness, cruelty, intelligence, folly, and so on. Therefore, being ambivalent, we function dualistically, and hence there is a constant mental unbalance and uncertainty. And hence so many of the mistakes we make in our lives. Here note a significant difference in our approaches to our bodily needs and our psychological needs. As far as our bodily needs are concerned, they are concrete, they are material, and we can, in a matter-of-fact way, say enough food and warmth or not enough food and warmth. And we can deal with them in a sensible way. On the whole, not everybody deals with his needs for food, for instance, in a sensible way. But that can be rectified always. Now, with regard to our psychological needs, we long for them. And we cannot long quantitatively for happiness and love and peace of mind and so forth. We long with a degree of intensity which is not measurable. And in actual fact, we long so intensely that we want complete security, absolute success, eternal love, everlasting happiness, perfect peace. But these are not finite terms. They are not measurable. Perfect, eternal, absolute, these take us out of the concrete material context into the transcendent, unlimited, unconditioned sphere. We must note this very carefully, because this gives us the key to understanding the nature of our lives, the purpose of our existence, and the road to the fulfillment of that purpose. How is it with us in actual fact in our everyday life here and now? Psychologically, we have some love, some peace, some success, some happiness at times. And at other times, we have their opposite. We function dualistically. But we long intensely for the whole, the perfect, not the partial. We want the complete thing, the absolute thing. Thus, we are conscious, even dimly, of a strong desire to go beyond the bounds of the limited and finite towards the infinite and the eternal, to move out of the sphere of the imperfect and incomplete into the perfect and the complete. Therefore, although we now experience life and are aware of the world in terms of duality and conflict, our basic urge is towards being fully conscious in terms of wholeness and peace. Here we see an example of progressive change in our consciousness. Although at this stage, it is still in terms of desiring that which is transcendent, only for our own self. And this is where we make one of our root mistakes. We cannot desire for the self at the expense of or neglecting the not-self. because we are completely interconnected, completely interrelated, and completely interacting. But we are ignorant of that fact. And we are ignorant of the ways in which this interaction takes place. At this point, let us ask a crucial question. In what manner are we conscious of all existence? Through the functioning of the senses and the brain, we see objects in the world as separate from each other. We see human beings as different from each other. We do not see the relationships, the complete relationships which exist throughout the world, throughout the universe, in fact. Therefore, we are separatively conscious of objects, and we are isolatively conscious of ourselves. If you look into your own minds and examine in what manner am I conscious of myself, you will discover that you are extremely vividly conscious of yourself. But are you equally conscious of your neighbor, or your wife, or your husband, or those who are nearest and dearest to you, or those with whom you have worked for the last 50 or 60 years? Are you really conscious of them? Or are you vividly conscious only of yourself? And then consider the extraordinary fact. This is the very troublesome fact in human life. As regards ourself, we say myself. As regards the rest of the universe, we say the not self. What an extraordinary disproportion between oneself, just one little fragment of an infinitely great universe, and the rest of the universe. Now you see, this isolative self-consciousness, which separates us so deeply, so strongly from the rest of the universe, is the root source of all our conflict, our misery, and our evils. Being very conscious of ourselves, we would certainly do everything we can to avoid harm to ourselves. But how do we avoid it? Often, alas, too often, at the expense of others. Now we must bear this in mind. Therefore, this change of consciousness, this change of consciousness into an intensity of awareness of the unity of the universe has to grow. As long as this self and not self separation exists, it blinds us to our personal responsibility for the condition of the world. How easily we say, oh, that's not my business, I had nothing to do with it. This is a great error. The state of the world, and you all know how terrible it is at present, is the natural resultant and expression of our individual state of consciousness. If we were truly aware, truly conscious of our neighbor, of the person whom we say we love, who is our friend, and so forth, if we were truly conscious, then there'd be no conflict between him and us. Because that all-embracing consciousness would enable all our thought and feeling, our speech and action, to function in a totally different way. Not the dualistic way of good, bad, love, hate and so forth, but in terms of the absolute good of transcendent love and wisdom and beauty and goodness. Now, because we function in this manner, man exploits man. He misuses objects, wealth, and power. And he lives unecologically, all to his own detriment. Consider very carefully the misuse of power and wealth. Man, through the centuries, through the millennia, has madly pursued wealth and power first, without allowing love and wisdom to come to fruition within him. And therefore, being unloving, being unwise, it is impossible for him not to misuse power. And again, I refer you to the history of the whole world, and we'll see that every time power has come into our hands, in any form whatsoever, the first thing we do is to misuse it. Are we doomed then to perpetual confinement within isolative self-consciousness? Are we doomed to wars, pain, destruction, and so much unnecessary sorrow and suffering? There is sorrow and suffering which no one can avoid. Volcanoes, earthquakes, floods. We can't do anything about that. But so much of our suffering is unnecessary sorrow and suffering which we could very well have avoided. Are we doomed to that? Or is there another mode of awareness of all existence, a truly human mode in harmony with all, a unitary whole consciousness? Is there? Have you never in your lifetime experience those magical moments when the restless activity of the brain had become calm, all the senses were alert, the emotions were still, and the mind was in an unusually peaceful state? And in this state, your dormant potentiality for clear-sighted perception of profound truth became so intense that your innermost consciousness became fully aware, in a very quiet and a very matter-of-fact way, of transcendent reality. Not reality as we understand it here and now. So that the tragic separation between self and not self vanished, and you knew beyond all argument that you, the particular person, and every other living creature and object in the universe were in complete relationship with each other, and that what we, in our ignorance, called this world and that world were in actual fact only one world, the one total reality, transcendence itself in its wholeness, one unbroken holiness, infinite, eternal, immortal, blissful, whose silence included the sound of the whole song of universal life, unheard by earthly ears, unknown by a mere brain, unseen by mortal eyes. But in this state, you are entirely conscious of complete security, perfect peace, eternal love, everlasting happiness, and infinity, eternity, and immortality were not mere words, vain dreams, or just pious hopes, but actualities, the all-embracing truth, the simple fact of the whole universe. Some call this nature mysticism. Others call it the religious experience, or the unio mystica, or the divine revelation, and so on. The names given are not specially important. What is of deep practical significance for us is its central feature. You have experienced the most critical and priceless progressive change, namely, that your worldly mode of awareness of all existence was completely transformed, for the time being at least, into the transcendent mode. Thereby, one of the purposes of your existence was fulfilled, and you had the true vision of man's destiny, a divine destiny. So, when you emerge out of this transcendent state, as necessarily we must, if only to satisfy the body's natural demands, and function again in ordinary consciousness in your everyday life, you are animated by a loving, a wise, and a living and undying faith, and this is true faith, that the soul's longing for transcendence can be realized here and now in our life in the world. And whilst we are once again in ordinary consciousness, quite naturally there arises the question, is it possible for us to be constantly awake to this transcendent reality? And if so, what is the way? This is where religion, in its profoundest meaning and significance, comes in. It is the living of the religious life, the holy life, which effects the transformation of our worldly mode of awareness of all existence into the transcendent mode, the supreme progressive change for man. The word religion is the same as the Latin religio. That Roman philosopher, and he was a very profound philosopher, Cicero, in his treatise, the De Natura Deorum, on the nature of the gods, associates the word religio with re legere, which means to gather together. Now this is very interesting for us, because you will find in the Aurumas, the Yast, when Ahura Mazda is answering one of Zarathustra's questions as regards what is one of the most powerful means for dealing with evil and conflict in ourselves. And Ahura Mazda says, our names, O Zarathustra. And the second name which he gives is Vathvio, the gatherer. I have sometimes wondered whether Cicero, in some way or other, perhaps was acquainted with some of the Zarathustrian teachings, because this is how he defines religion. That which gathers together to collect again. Other thinkers, such as Servius, Lactantius, St. Augustine, relate religio to re ligare, which means to bind back, to fasten. To bind back to what? To transcendence, to God. One is reminded of the definition of yoga, derived from yuj, which means to join together. To join together what? That which had got separated. Yourself and God. Myself and God. But I was responsible. You have been responsible for the separation, not God. Not transcendence. Because the unity of the universe everlastingly remains a unity. You can't do anything against it. You can spoil it. You can hinder it. You can try to break it asunder. And that is the root meaning of the word sin. The word sin is not confined to moral wrongdoing. But that deep in your consciousness itself, you have cut yourself adrift. Not your fault. We are born that way, ignorant. But still, we do nothing to mend the fault. So, we can take the word dharma. The word dharma is derived from the root dhri. Dhri means to uphold. And way back in the Rig Veda, this was taught. To uphold what? To uphold Ritta, the eternal order of things inherent in each and every thing and creature composing the universe. That eternal order of things is the power, the unknown, mysterious, invincible power, which holds the universe together and brings everything in the universe to its fulfillment and fruition. So you see, dharma essentially means that. And our great scholar and teacher, one of our great teachers, the late Dr. Iraj J. Taraporwala, has associated the word Asha, our Zarathustrian word Asha, with Ritta. They are derived from the same root. They are related to each other. Now, it would be very helpful to take the Greek word theos for God. Now, if you go into the root of the word theos, it means supreme desire or love. Transcendent desire, not our ordinary wayward desires and impulses, but the supreme desire. You'll find it in the Upanishads. Kama. Kama has its lesser meaning, that which spoils things. It means lust. But lust, the German Lust, originally means light. You see? So, if you take it in its true sense, and also the Greek god Eros. Unfortunately, we think of the word of the name Eros only in terms of the derived adjective erotic. But Eros and Karma actually originally stood for that creative power, that creative action in eternity by which the whole universe came into being. And it is Eros who bestows immortality upon all the gods. So you see how deep all this goes and shows us, gives us some glimpse of what lies in front of us as far as our fulfillment, growth and fruition is concerned. Now take the Latin word Deus for God. Now Deus is derived from the Sanskrit root div, which means first and foremost to shine, and secondly it means to give. In the Avesta we have Hu Deo for Ahura Mazda. The prefix Hu means good. It means happy. Good, happy in the sense and in the degree which enables complete fulfillment to take place. And we have Hu Mata, Hu Ukta, Hu Varashta, and so on. It's good in that sense, not in the relative sense, but in the absolute sense. And the absolute sense wholly contains within itself the relative sense. In the relative sense, we experience conflict, and it is because that conflict stimulates us, we try to understand and solve this problem of ambivalence within ourselves. When that is done, then the absolute, the transcendent, functions freely through you, the purified individual, who has become the full human being. Then indeed we can call ourselves human beings. Until then we are a little bit under, in the stage where we are under, less than full humanity. We are sub-human. So now, note these 2 points. Deus shining means therefore light. It means the day, and in all the scriptures of the world the first meaning of the word day is enlightened consciousness. That's what the word day stands for. It stands therefore for wisdom, for transcendent wisdom, for the enlightened mind. And these two have been regarded as the supreme characteristics, the terms in which we human beings can attribute to the transcendent, to the divine, God, or whatever word you like to use. Transcendent love, transcendent wisdom. I've said all this because the meaning of the word human now becomes clearer. Hu, I have already dealt with. It's the good, the absolute good, the happy. But man, man, the root is man. If you look at the dictionary, you will find man associated, of course, the verb manyate is derived from man. And this, and the dictionary will say it means to think. Yes, in the extremely limited sense only. Because when we read to think, we immediately imagine that it means what we understand by thinking. Have you ever tried to look into your mental processes and discover what all this thinking is about? Have you ever discovered that it is a continual flow of language? Whether that language be verbal or pictorial or oral or in terms of any of the sense functionings. But the sense functionings do not exhaust all the possibilities that lie within our being. Therefore, that is all so partial, and our so-called thinking on the whole, for the majority of human beings, is mere futile chatter. Constant chatter in the brain. Do you think that this creative power, with its constant creative action in eternity, produced the world by chattering? Does it ever chatter? Does God ever chatter? Have you ever heard that chatter? Or have you ever heard God speak? There's no language there. There is no particular expression, no limitation of the transcendent, infinite, the immeasurable, the eternal and the immortal. And yet the scriptures of the world have no option but to say the creative word. And God said, let there be, and there was. Well, let us try that. Let there be a grand piano in this room. Do you think a grand piano will suddenly appear? It certainly won't. Or even a plate of danshak. It just won't appear by saying, let there be a plate of danshak. Isn't that so? Now, man is the root from which our word man, our word mind comes in. And it is very interesting to note how this has been presented in the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus. In that marvelous treatise known as Thrice Greatest Hermes, in the second volume you will find this. Mind is Father God. All Father Mind, all Father Mind, being light and life, did bring forth man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love as being his own child. For he was beautiful beyond compare, the image of his sire. I would prefer to use the word the living likeness of his sire, not image. Image brings up the idea of an idol, a dead thing, a fossil. But in the living likeness, that is how we were created. But what is this we? This is what we have to discover in the course of our life. In very truth, God fell in love with his own form. You and I are the form of God himself, or itself, if you prefer the word it. And on him did bestow all his own formations. The possibility in consciousness of infinity, eternity, immortality and bliss. That is man. Mind, then, is the archetypal form of creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. Man is a creator like God, and man also is supremely characterized in his perfection and fulfillment by transcendent love and transcendent wisdom. Thus we get a glimmer of the meaning of man and the divine potentialities inherent in him, man is indeed the most advanced microcosm on earth. Who then brought religion to us, gave us religious teachings, and showed us the way to the full realization of our human potential, to the release of transcendence embodied and lying hidden in our own being? Do not imagine that some sort of external God descended from heaven and gave these teachings. Any such idea which makes of God a finite personal entity, a personal being separate from the universe, is a false idea, for the very simple reason that any finite entity is not characterized in itself by infinity, eternity, immortality. Infinity negates finitude. It is men who did this, brought religion into the world and gave religious teachings. And how and why? Because they themselves, in consciousness, had flowered out into full manhood and realized the actuality of eternity and immortality in their own consciousness. And having realized that, they saw that this is that primordial creative energy through whose activity the whole universe comes into being and is maintained, and ultimately through time brought to fruition, a fruition which then shows that time is completely subsumed in eternity, and death and birth are completely subsumed in immortality, everlasting life. It is men then who taught us and gave us religion. The teachers discovered for themselves the way of realization. They saw the purposes of our existence, and they embodied what they saw and fulfilled. In their own persons, they were the living revelations of transcendence. Men of vision they were, not liable to delusion, men of purity, truth, goodness, wisdom, and compassion. They were the awakeners of man, the healers of the sick soul, the doctors and teachers, not only of the sick soul, but also of the healed soul. Which psychologist, which psychiatrist today really knows what the healed soul is like? This is what the founders of the great religions discovered for themselves. That is why their influence has changed the course of history, certainly during the last 6,000 years. Their supreme concern was our true welfare and our happiness, our fulfillment. And so they taught us how to live our daily life in order that we could realize perfect manhood. The essence of their teachings may be summarized thus. First, their constant emphasis on the indispensability of living in accordance with a pure ethic, not a relative ethic, a pure ethic, a transcendental ethic, culminating in a transcendental morality. Second, how we could disengage ourselves from the binding chains of constant preoccupation with self, selfness, and self affairs, and direct our attention to the genuinely worthy objectives of human endeavor. Thirdly, the art of living constantly in the meditative state. Now be careful, not just musing, in the truly meditative state, in samadhi, in true communion within the one total reality. I don't say with the one total reality, because in that type of expression, one is separating oneself from the totality. You see how very subtle this basic sinfulness, separating ourselves from the totality, comes in. But within that totality, the communion is realized. These teachings of the Holy Ones are the very heart of the scriptures of the great religions. The heart which heals the psyche of its sickness and its evil, which is the root of sin and confusion and sorrow in all the world. Thus, this heart establishes us in health, in holiness, which spells the maturity of the mind and frees us from the tormenting conflict between the twin mainyu, the spenta mainyu and the akem mainyu. In our next meeting, I will say a few words about this. It enables the sensitivity to transcendence, deeply hidden in our innermost being, to spring to life and become a beacon light, inspiring and guiding our everyday thought, word and deed. It changes our worldliness, the dwelling place of our consciousness in the miserable hovel of bondage and mortality, into godliness, which is true humanness, the dwelling place which is the eternal house of song, the true Garudamana, of pure and unshakable freedom of mind. The religious life sets us unconditionally free, and we live in the consciousness of the deathless immortal. Such is the meaning and significance of religion and religious living.